Well, peace, friends. My name is Sarah, and I'm a volunteer on the teaching team here at Sycamore Creek, and I'm excited to be part of this series where we're going to be talking about parenting through Proverbs. And I'm just going to pause right there. For those of you who do not have kids or don't have kids in your home right now, I just want to say that you are in this with us, whether you like it or not. You're part of a church family, which means that you are helping to walk alongside families and to raise up children and teenagers to walk with Jesus. And so you are part of this message. This whole series is also for you. It's not just for those who have kids in their home right now. And so, you know, we are talking together as a congregation about this because we want to all be on the same page of what does it mean to raise up kids to walk with Jesus. If I know that you all are on that page with me as I raise up my kids, and we are all on the same page as we work with the teens in our congregation, then we're part of a family. And that's, we're all in this together. And so, but if you do have friends that have kids, even if you don't, this is a great series to invite them. We have two more messages after this coming up. And just be praying for folks on this journey, whether it's your own grown children, neighbors, people that you know that just need some encouragement in their lives as parents. So we're going to have a text Q&A at the end of this. And what that means is that at the end of my message, you're going to have a chance to lob questions at me via text. And this is a little bit like Erin was describing in her message one time, like you're just like firecrackers are being, those little popping ones on the ground are being shot at you, and you're like, ah, 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 do that to me today. This is a performance art. Let's see how we do. So text to that number right there your questions about interacting with teens, about, yeah, make it tough, okay? And Erin Umstead's going to be part of that, and she's a teacher at Hull High School, so if I can't answer the question, Erin is going to have some wisdom to share as well about that. So keep that number in your mind and start texting throughout the service as questions come up. But yes, during this series, we are looking at four stages of parenting, four stages that congregations are interacting with and that families are interacting with of parenting. And those stages are your parenting style as a Christian parent, as a Christian congregation, changes as your students get older, as your kids grow up. And so each stage is different, and we're looking at the parenting stage of the discipline years when children are ages 0 to 5. We're going to be looking at that eventually. And the discipline not being a negative discipline and then negative use of that word, but a positive discipline. We're going to be looking at when our children are ages 6 to 11 in this congregation, what's happening up in Kids Creek? What's happening in your home when our kids are those ages? Those are the training years. You're raising up hopefully functioning humans in the world, right? And then ages 12 to 18 is what we're talking about today. Those are the coaching years. This is when parents and congregations are, they can't play the game for their kids. We are sending our teens out during their day, and I can't hold their hand as their youth worker to make the choices in their life. I can't play this game for you. I can't hold the ball. I can't dribble it, but I can cheer you on. I can give you all the tools and strategies you need to play this game of life well. So those are the coaching years. And then after that are the friendship years. Many of you are in that place right now where either you are the grown child of somebody or you have grown children. Thanksgiving is when we work on the friendship years, right? We're all going to show up with our casseroles and be like, this is about friendship, right? This is not easy, but we have ways to talk about that as a congregation too and as communities. So those are the stages. And today we're a little out of order, but we're going to look at the coaching years. And I may seem like a kind of strange person to do that because I myself don't have teenagers under my roof. I have a 4 and a 6-year-old. But I have been involved in youth ministry with teens for all of my adult life. When I started off 22 years ago, fresh out of college, I was a full-time youth director at a church for 7 years. And then after that, continued as a volunteer and as a mentor with teens. But then I had this weird blip in my life where I published a book that became a bestseller in Christian publishing, and it was a youth devotional book. And so all of a sudden, my youth ministry went from like 20 kids in my church to like 80,000 teenagers. And it was this wild ride of suddenly realizing that teens all over the country and their parents needed encouragement in their faith, not just the ones in my home church. And so I began writing more books for teenagers, writing curriculum, and then also training youth leaders all around the country. So things like I'd be invited even to British Columbia to train youth leaders in the United Church of Canada, or then to Princeton Theological Seminary as the theologian in residence with the youth ministry forums. And so you get this like this way overqualified person coming here to just do this dump of all of my expertise and information on you, and you didn't have to fly me here. I just show up, and it's my home congregation, and I'm really excited to share some thoughts with you today. As Christian communities, how do we coach our young people? As Christian families, how do we coach our young people? So we're going to be using two resources through this series. The first is the book of Proverbs. This is Parenting Through Proverbs. It's an Old Testament book that's a collection of wisdom from King Solomon, the ancient kings of Israel. And we are going to then also have a resource that is pretty common in households. If anybody in our church has Dr. Seuss books at home, this is going to help, because that's a visual reminder of some of the principles we're going to be talking about, collections of Dr. Seuss. So my book today from Dr. Seuss is called And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. It was Dr. Seuss's very first book that he published. And he admitted towards the end of his life that he wasn't always culturally sensitive or culturally aware. So it's interesting in this book. We're trying to be sensitive about that. But he later changed some of his views and grew in some of his views about issues of race. And so we're still going to make use of this book to talk about how this parent is coaching their child for better or worse. All right, so let's watch.
And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street. When I leave home to walk to school, Dad always says to me, Marco, keep your eyelids up and see what you can see. But when I tell him where I've been and what I think I've seen, he looks at me and sternly says, your eyesight's much too keen. Stop telling such outlandish tales. Stop turning minnows into whales. All the long way to school and all the way back, I've looked and I've looked, and I've kept careful track. But all that I've noticed, except my own feet, was a horse and a wagon on Mulberry Street. That can't be my story. That's only a start. I'll say that a zebra was pulling that cart. But it isn't too late to make one little change. A sleigh and an elephant. There's something strange. But he'd simply look grand with a great big brass band. A band that's so good should have someone to hear it, but it's going so fast that it's hard to keep near it. I'll put on a trailer. I know they won't mind if a man sits and listens while hitched on behind. And that makes a story that's really not bad. But it still could be better. Suppose that I add a big magician doing tricks, a 10-foot beard that needs a comb. No time for more, I'm almost home, for I had a story that no one could beat, and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street. But Dad said quite calmly, just draw up your stool and tell me the sights on the way home from school. There was so much to tell, I just couldn't begin. Dad looked at me sharply and pulled at his chin. He frowned at me sternly from there in his seat. Was there nothing to look at? No people to greet? Nothing, I said, growing red as a beet. But a plain horse and wagon on Mulberry Street.
All right, so we see a parent coaching their child on what not to do, on a very sort of limited sense of what their son's role is in the world, but not a very strong ability to engage what's possible, right? What is possible in the world? And so so we want to look at the ways that coaching is much, much more rich than that approach. That's kind of an example of what not to do, right? So let's take a look. What do coaches do? And we're going to just spend our time unpacking these things. What do coaches do? A coach sets a clear boundaries for their team, for their players. That's what a coach does, sets clear boundaries. And then a coach also sets the vision and identifies the goal. This is what winning looks like. A coach is going to put the poster of a winning player up on the wall of the locker room. A coach is going to show that last awesome shot in a game where the crowd went wild. What does that look like? What does winning look like? And then a coach articulates and follows through on a clear strategy. How do we get there? How do we win? How do we reach our goal? All right, so those are the three things that coaches do. And how does that translate then to what congregations do with teenagers? How does that translate then for what parents do with teenagers and grandparents? So a coach sets clear boundaries. And unfortunately, a lot of churches and a lot of parents just kind of begin and end there, right? We're like, okay, just don't do drugs, don't have sex, don't get drunk, don't commit a felony accidentally, don't, right? We have all these things we don't want you doing. It's almost as if we're standing here and all of their life is a minefield, and we're just saying, no, not there, no, okay, to the left, no. That's the sum total of our engagement with teenagers, is what not to do. And of course, it's kind of important to do that because the stakes are pretty high, right? We can make life-altering decisions as teenagers that don't necessarily set us up to thrive. And so as parents, we want to set those clear boundaries. Stop doing bad stuff. Now the challenge, of course, is that this developmental stage is often driven by impulses. We have lots of hormones going on. We have a lot of pressure from the rest of our friends and from the rest of culture on our sexuality and on our social status. How cool are we? On the stimulants that are in our body that supposedly help us make it through the day. There's a ton of ways that our impulses are driving a lot of our decisions at this stage. In fact, scientists talk about the prefrontal cortex, which is that part of your brain that like gives you that moment of like, oh, that may not be a good idea. That part of your brain at this developmental stage is actually asleep at the wheel most of the time. So, you know, a parent is like to the teen, like, what were you thinking? And the teenager can legitimately say, I wasn't, right? That part of me was not functioning. That part that says, no, not a good idea. And then when you get a bunch of people all with their prefrontal cortex asleep in one room, like a cafeteria or a car, it's like bigger than the sum of its parts. You know, and the kid gets home and is like, I don't even know what just happened. Okay. Yeah, they don't. There's a developmental stage where impulses often drive everything, and it is absolutely okay for the parent to train a student to check those impulses, to train their child. And the reason why is because sometimes adults who love kids are the only ones doing that. Our consumer culture is all about indulging our impulses, right? Yeah, if you can get somebody to indulge their impulses, you can make lots of money off of them. Teenagers are a huge multi-billion dollar consumer market, along with their parents and grandparents. If you're not sure about that, I encourage you to watch a PBS Frontline documentary that came out a number of years ago called The Merchants of Cool, about how companies spend millions of dollars to find out what teens think is cool, and then so that they can turn around and sell it right back to you and to their parents. You know, I don't know how many of us have parents have ever written to Nike or Abercrombie or, you know, Under Armour and said, what are your intentions with my child? And what do you think they'd say if they were honest? I'm gonna make money off y'all, lots of money. Guess what, they have health insurance and a pension, right? Yeah, if you can get them now while they're driven by impulses, you've got them for life as consumers. That's a genius plan. It's a genius plan, they're making money off y'all. They were making money off of me. And so our culture is gonna continually pressure us to give in to impulses because there's money in that. There's money in that. There's also a kind of thrill of excitement in some of it. You know, we like to feel that little surge of fun, whatever that means. Whatever that means. And so as parents, it is absolutely okay. It is congregations, it is absolutely okay to set boundaries and to check that indulgence, to help them exercise self-restraint. So King Solomon in his wisdom talks about like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. If you think of an ancient city that would have a wall around all of the houses and that, but then the cities also, you know, when archaeologists look at the ancient cities, those houses were built into the wall. Like your outer wall of your house was the outer wall of the city. So if your wall is broken down, your life is broken. You have no protection. You've lost every way to protect yourself. And so part of our job is to help them exercise self-restraint. So yes, a coach sets boundaries. This is key. But that's not all a coach does, right? Like if a coach got the team together and that coach, she was trying to get them to play basketball really well, and all she says is, Jenny, you know what? You just keep traveling the ball. I don't understand it. You just travel. It's all you do. Why can't you stop traveling the ball? Just stop hanging out with people that travel the ball. Like it's constant. What are you thinking? Okay, now go out there and win. All right, is that all that a coach is doing when you get those team members together? No, the coach is then setting the vision of what it takes to win. So as a congregation, as parents, we do that too. But we have to be really clear on what winning means. What does it mean to win? If we're speaking as Christians, not just as citizens, what does it mean to win? Of course, you know, our consumer culture is going to say to win means success. Yep, not just being stable, but having lots of money, right? Of course, we want our kids to support us in our old age. That would be lovely. But yeah, success, having plenty of money to spend all those dollars on all those things. Yes, but also to be stable. We do want our kids to be stable, right? But then our culture also will add a sort of, we want them to also be good citizens. You know, pay your taxes, you know, drive the speed limit. We have this rubric for what winning looks like. But is that the whole story for Christians? Is that really it? Be a good citizen, you know, be successful. And when we look to Jesus, we see, no, that's not the whole story. What we set before our kids is a vision like more like this. Winning means walking with Jesus every day so lives can be transformed. Not just your own life, but the lives of your friends, the lives of your culture and your community. Walking with Jesus every day so lives can be transformed. You know, we do this a lot at Teen Fuel. We are continually trying to remind our students that it is not just about being successful. It's not just about being a good citizen, but walking with Jesus. A verse we use a lot is where we're encouraged to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. That's what winning looks like. You know, Tom and I often have to kind of regroup. Lately, we have a first grader and a preschooler, and our preschooler has gotten homework. And so, you know, I've actually put notes on it before. He will do this if he wants to. Send it back to school. Our preschooler is getting homework. And, you know, Tom and I value education, right? I mean, you know, we value higher education, like places like Duke. And this is important to us. And yet, we have to keep in mind that if Micah chooses to be a car mechanic, and he is seeking to walk with Jesus, and he's seeking to love the Lord his God with everything he's got, and he gives me a really good discount on fixing my car, it's good. We've gotten there. That's what winning looks like. But if, you know, my son chooses to be a doctor, to be a lawyer, to make a lot of money, but he is not walking with Jesus, he is not loving the Lord his God, then there's a piece of this picture that is missing, right? As Christians, we are calling our kids to something more. Also in Proverbs, the writer of Proverbs gives wisdom itself a persona. You know, you're making wise choices, and that has a persona. And actually, that persona is a she. Wisdom is a she in Proverbs. And so here she is, and she's speaking, and she's saying, "Now then, my children, listen to me. Blessed are those who keep my ways. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Do not disregard it. Blessed are those who listen to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. For those who find me," here's the vision, you ready? "For those who find me find life and receive favor from the Lord. But those who fail to find me harm themselves, and all who hate me love death." We all know people who have failed to find wisdom, right? And we've seen that harm played out in their lives, maybe even our own lives. But we're seeking after that life that is really life. That's what we want for our teens, that they would know God's favor, his peace, his grace, his presence. I am so grateful that I have a family who reiterated this to me. It's a gift I can't ever repay. This is a picture of my grandfather, Grandpa Fallman, my dad's dad. He lived to be 100. He was born in 1911. He died in 2011, and Micah, my son, my oldest, was born in late 2010. So here's a picture of my grandfather holding Micah as an infant. And I remember taking Micah to visit my grandfather in hospice, and he was still, you know, my grandpa was still lucid. He was right up to the end. And so I gave my son to him and to hold, and I said, "Grandpa, is there anything you want to say to Micah? Is there anything you want to tell him?" And my grandfather said, "Oh, yes. We want you to know that we love you, and that there's nothing better than walking with Jesus all your life. There's nothing better." Think of all the things he could have told him. You know, don't mess up. Be a good citizen. You know, make your parents proud. He said, "There's nothing better than walking with Jesus." If you've been alive for 100 years and you lived through all the wars that he lived through, the death of a child, all of the things that my grandfather experienced, and you can say that, then you have the chops to speak, okay? He knows what he's talking about. There's nothing better. All those other choices, there's nothing better. He didn't say there's nothing easier. Did you catch that? But there is nothing better. That was put before me as a young person. That was put before my sons. We can say those things out loud to the children and teens in our lives. We can name what it looks like to walk with Jesus. My grandfather's 100th birthday party, we invited people to come from the community and just share what my grandpa meant to them, stories about him. And one woman said, "You know, Mr. Fallman, I would walk down to your grocery store," and he had a little mom and pop corner grocery store, "and my family never had much money, so when I got in, I'd, you know, take a look at my change and realize I didn't have enough to pay for the candy that I really wanted. And you would always say, 'Oh, did I not put the sign out? Yeah, that's on sale today.'" These are small things that nobody knew but her. There were so many unpaid tabs at that store when it finally closed. I mean, people just, he helped out because he was called to walk with Jesus. Though it wasn't easy, it was better. It was the best way to live. We can say those things to our kids. We can set that vision before them of what it means to win. But we also need to help them get there, right? You can set the vision, but what is the actual strategy? How do we actually get to that place where we are very consciously walking with Jesus? What are the strategies for that? How do we do that with teenagers in particular? Well, here at Sycamore Creek, we have what we call our discipleship pathway, which is a really fancy way of saying, here are the ways that we walk with Jesus, that we follow Jesus. This is the path that we try to take. And it's not prescriptive. It never really ends. We cycle back through all of these all the time. And they are these. We want people to connect with God and connect with this faith community. We want that connect part to be part of our discipleship. And then we also want people to grow. Who I am in my relationship with God is different now than it was last year. And we pray for the better, right? And that's intentional. We want to be growing in our walk with Jesus. And then we also want to be serving. This is a huge way that we are disciples with Jesus, because this is what Jesus did. He served out of love people in a hurting world. And so we grow in our relationship with Jesus by serving. And this is no different for teenagers than it is for the adults in our church or for the children in our church. The teens are not some subspecies of human that requires different strategies than it does for the rest of us. They're worshiping the same Jesus who said the same things in the Bible to them that God says to us. And so we want to just give you a snapshot of how Sycamore Creek Church is helping teens do this, and the teens themselves are helping us stay accountable to helping them do this. And the signature way, and then this is huge, and you make this possible, is what we call Teen Fuel Cafe. Let's shout out for that, because that's a really cool graphic, and I'm really excited about it. And I'm really excited about all the people that make that happen, from students all the way up to adult leaders. There's a ton of them in this room. You may not know who they are, so just, you know, they're undercover. I won't make them stand up right now. But we cannot make Teen Fuel happen without them. If the adults didn't show up, Teen Fuel could probably run, honestly. Like, the students make it happen. But together as a team, every Sunday night, we fill that Connection Cafe with food and music and students, and from 6:30 to 8 p.m., 6th through 12th graders come, and one of the first things they are taught to do is to invite their friends, right? This is not a little group where we just close in on ourselves and this is the cool thing to do. It is an invitational opportunity for them to invite their friends. We have a ton of kids coming to Teen Fuel that have no faith community, that don't worship anywhere, or whose parents can't help them get to church. And so on a Sunday night, there we are. We've got some live music in that picture. That was fun. I see Anna Shoemaker playing on the cajon, the drum. And then some guests are there. And folks, that, you know, we keep getting kids that come and then they don't leave. They just keep coming every week. It's been really, really fun. But we train our students, our core group, to that connect piece, to be invitational. And we want their friends there. We want them to feel like it's something they can that they can say, this is important. We need to do this together. Come with me, right? But we also then break into small groups, and that's where they grow in their faith. And then in the third thing is they serve. This is our media team, or some of them on the media team. And there's Pastor Mark, who is our Teen Fuel pastor every Sunday night. And these are the students, that some of them, that make things happen. So they're learning competencies. All right, one of the studies that was done on congregations that retain students through 12th grade said there are a number of things that those churches do to keep those kids through 12th grade. And one of them is milestones, like things that they're looking forward to. Like every year, this seniors always do this. And another thing that congregations do with teens is regular rituals of spiritual practices together, which is why praying at Teen Fuel is a really big deal. We close every single week with talking about our highs for the week, our lows for the week, and the Lord's Prayer. It's important. These are faith practices that they're learning. And then another thing that congregations do to retain students through graduation is they provide opportunities for them to develop competencies. They learn how to serve. And the church can't run without them on a Sunday morning or on a Sunday night or at Buddy's. These are goals that we have for retaining our students through 12th grade. Is opportunities to serve. So, you know, we have lots of different ways that we do that as a congregation through Teen Fuel Cafe, but then there are ways that you on the ground can do this, that you also, whether you have teens in your life or not, can do this. And we're going to get to some of those in a minute, but before we do, you may be having just some nuts and bolts questions. And those questions, I hope you texted for our text Q&A. But while Aaron's coming up, I'm going to talk about an important way that we're giving teens an opportunity to serve this summer, and that is we're having a special Nicaragua mission trip. It's not during the school year when the teens can't go, the teens and their parents and families. It's going to be in June, and I'm super excited because the students will stay in Managua instead of going out into the countryside, and they will do home visits with some of the leaders and the interpreters that will be with us, and they will also have the opportunity to work with Dr. Mir, on ministry to the children on the streets of Managua. Kids that come, upwards of 60 kids, to have breakfast and to have almost vacation Bible school kinds of games and songs with Dr. Mir. And our students get to be part of that with their parents and their families and key mentors. And I'm just super, super excited about that. Yeah, yeah, you too. Aw, see, you can't say no to that. All right, yeah. Okay, so.
Yay.
We're going to take some questions now.
Nice
and,
job,
I just need to say that Aaron, as I've mentioned, is a teacher at Holt High School with ninth graders and 12th graders. So you must sleep well at night.
I do. And my prayer life is banging.
I bet. I bet.
Never,
there's some stuff
never
going on.
Run out of things to pray about. No, so no. I understand now why my mom had holes in her jean knees praying for me. Awesome. Well, thank you for having me up here. This is exciting.
Sure.
So this question came in. What is the hardest thing to navigate in youth ministry, and how do you persevere through it?
What is the hardest thing for me or anyone in youth ministry?
Let's go with you.
Okay. Probably the hardest thing for me to navigate is just the weight of what decisions face kids and how they have to leave Teen Fuel on a Sunday night and head out into their week. And I can't be with them. Their parents can't be with them, you know, in those choices. That's the hardest thing because, I seek Jesus, you know, and I want him to be with them. And I know he is, but I'm not sure they always sense that he is. So I think my hardest thing is just letting them walk out the door on Sunday night. I know they're going home, and that's good, but then the rest of the week, that's the hardest thing. But I'll have them in my home in just a few years, so that's just temporary.
Yep. How do you get teens who are secretive or just closed mouths to talk to you as a parent about their real feelings or the choices and challenges they're facing?
Yeah. Yep. We experienced that in small group. On Sunday nights in Ignite groups. I think that giving them two things. One is continuing to offer spaces within the family for conversations. When we're really working hard or in moments when we don't actually like our children and they don't like us, it's really easy to be like, that conversation needs to happen another time. Or to just not build that into your family life. But I use the example of a youth ministry expert named Roland Martinson, who talks about when his daughter hit puberty, she just like basically went in her room and didn't talk to anybody for like 8 years and then came out again and was like talking to people. And so he was determined that he was still going to do the same nighttime routine that he did with her when she was little. And he would knock on her bedroom door and he would go on in and say, "So what was the high point of your day? What was the low point of your day?" And she wouldn't really say anything. And so he would just talk about the high point of his day and the low point of his day. And then he would pray with her, just pray the Lord's Prayer, and she wouldn't really say anything. And then later, when she was a college student, she brought a friend home. And by this point, his daughter was talking and engaging. And she would say, "You remember those great talks we used to have, Dad?" And he was like, "What are you talking about?" What she remembered was a grown-up saying, "This is important to be together," whether she said anything or not. She knew that she could if she needed to. And then the second thing is I would give students an opportunity to hang out with loving adults that they do open up to. I mean, bring them to Teen Fuel. I mean, there are people here that, one parent will be like, "My kid never talks." And I'm like, they don't stop talking at Teen Fuel in their small group. They don't. So how do we, encourage you as parents and as families to accept by providing opportunities for students to interact with loving and caring adults? So, yeah.
And parents of non-teenagers, it starts early. If you listen to their blather about their teddy bears and what they're doing and it makes no sense to you and it doesn't matter to you, it matters to them. And the little things turn into big things, and if they can tell you the little things, they'll keep telling you the big things.
Yes.
But do be ready for that freeze out that happens around 14. So much fun. I have nieces and nephews that are teenagers, and so this is all woohoo. Yeah. All right. Such great questions. How do you help them find a career path and discover their gifts and skills? That's one of our missions to them. Yeah. How do we do that?
Well, I think that opportunities to serve is a huge, huge part of that. So learning competencies. Like, it's great now for a student to volunteer in the nursery or at Kids Creek and realize, I really hate working with children. That's a great thing to discover when you're 12, as opposed to when you're 22 and you've just been through this whole program to become a teacher. So opportunities to serve is a really big part of that. And not just relying on the school to provide those opportunities, but to take advantage of what we offer in a church like this. And then, you know, being prayerful about vocation with them. Vocation, that word comes from vocare in Latin. It means to call. Like, your student is called to something, and how can you help them discern? And praying is a big part of that. Praying together, you know, they're really stressed about this test, and it's okay to pray about this now, because that stress will translate into stress about a job, and you can pray. And if they have the habit of praying with you about that, then those habits continue. So.
Nice job. Yeah,
thank you. It's done, right? Whew. We're good. Can you thank God for me with about Erin and her good work in our community? Thank you, Erin. All right. So I'd like you to, we're going to, again, look at a couple practical steps for how you, even if you don't have a teenager in your life right now, can come alongside of this congregation. And for parents who do have teens, can allow your church to come alongside you in this. You have a connection card. Some of you already have one that looks like this. All right, I encourage you to get that out right now. And if you haven't already started filling that out, to go ahead and do so. It's a great way for us to stay connected with you. But on the back, this is really key. On the back are some next steps for the next few weeks. And particularly related to how we help teens walk with Jesus. So some of these next steps, even if you don't have a teen in your life right now, are really key. And that is, learn a teen's name and greet them by name this month, whether it's in your neighborhood or in this church. Some of you have teens in your face all the time, and you're like, I don't want to deal with one more teenager. So let other people do this. Some of you don't interact with teens all week long, like you never even see a teenager. So your challenge is to learn a teen's name and to greet them by name. Now, don't be creepy about this, you know, just be normal. Every time I meet a student for the first time, all of my insecurities from junior high crop up. And so I just have to press on and be my own goofball self. And they often are more than gracious, right? So just greet them by name. Because if Mrs. Smith asks them next week, hey, where were you? I missed you. I've been praying for you. It's a lot harder to leave the church, y'all. It is a lot harder to just walk away when there are grown-ups that love you, that know when you're missing, and reach out to you. All right, so there's that. We also encourage you to serve with a teen, and we offer a really easy way to do that. We have a collection this month for Compassion Closet, which is a personal needs bank here in the city of Lansing, and that is an opportunity to help people whose food stamps don't cover things like toilet paper and toothpaste and stuff that, when it all adds up, can be very, very expensive, especially if you have kids. So Compassion Closet is important. Our teens have a goal of collecting like 5,000 items, I think, this month. I maybe just made that up, but let's go for it. 5,000 items. There's a crate back in the Connection Cafe where we're putting all that stuff. If you walked in and thought, wow, they really like toilet paper at Sycamore Creek. We do, because it helps us with our collection for Compassion Closet. So bring those in during the month of November. And then I'm going to encourage you to pray for a teenager. Pray for a teenager. If you've learned a teen's name, then that's a good one. Maybe somebody in your family or your neighborhood, somebody you heard about on the news. Pray for that student. This is just huge. Like, people often ask me what are ways that they can serve in Teen Fuel. And we have a Teen Fuel prayer team, actually, and it's made up of people who maybe don't have kids in the program and ideally don't have kids in the program, so that when the teens send in prayer requests, that team specifically prays just for our teens. We have a couple other things on next steps about cleaning the building. You should watch the teens when they set up and tear down in here. They do a pretty good job. And I'm challenging the adults to also step up. No shame, but step up. And then the Teen Fuel Fuel opportunity. These kids eat a lot of food, a lot of food. I will never turn down a gift card to a pizza place or Subway or anything for them. Kentucky Fried Chicken, I don't care. Just throw that stuff at me anytime. Gretchen, Pastor Mark, they eat a lot. So non-perishable items also are awesome. And if you happen to make like the best chocolate brownies, they will love you forever. It's like they walk in and it's like a hug from grandma at Teen Fuel. So chocolate brownies, you know, the baby carrots will sit there for weeks, but the brownies are gone. They're gone. All right, so all good stuff. I'm going to give you a chance to actually check off one of these items on your list right now, because we are going to pray for a teen to wrap up this message before we pass the offering buckets. And so right now, I invite you to close your eyes. I invite you to envision a student that you know, a teenager that you know, or one that you've read about or heard about, maybe in your family, someone in your family. And then picture that young person. And whatever they're doing right now, sleeping in, maybe they're here in the building somewhere. Whatever they're doing right now, God, I just pray that you would come alongside the teens that we're thinking of. Maybe they're our friends at school, someone in our family. Lord, you know everything about them. You made them. Jesus thought they were worth dying for. God, you have a plan for their life and a calling on them. And Lord, wherever they are right now, we pray that they would feel your love and grace and forgiveness and peace. Wherever they are, that they would just sense that they're not alone, that you are present with them. You love them, God, and that this faith community loves them. We lift them up to you and all the teens that will be walking through the halls of school and work and family life this week. We pray in the name of Jesus, and all God's people said, amen. Amen.